Hello, Steve. Very nice to have you on the podcast, the very first in-person recorded podcast. So it's great to have you on. And so, Steve, you're the initially you were the founder of the Fulham Reach Boat Club, and now you're working here at the River and Rowan Museum. And so we're just here to sort of talk a little bit about the museum, about your sort of roots at the Fulham Reach Boat Club, and then also you've done quite a lot around sort of sustainability of rivers, and obviously there's a lot of stuff at the moment about how there's sort of the E. coli and neurovirus in the water, which is obviously not ideal. And we'll sort of just talk a little bit about that as well, if you could.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, I'm a club rower by trade, if you like, so yeah. I rowed at my local school when I was growing up, so we just did like local comp, and we happened to have a boat and four of us that were keen, and then from there joined my local club, Notson Union, and then rowed at Leeds Uni and ended up doing lots of club rowing. So London Rowing Club was probably the most competitive racing I did, and was captain there for a bit, and then alongside that I had a proper job in air quotes, so I was in the world of corporate marketing, and then eventually just I spent all my time at work thinking about rowing, doing rowing things, particularly when I was first on the committee at London, I would come into the office and pretty much just do rowing stuff and then go home and try and fit in my job around it. So got to the point where I thought, I want to just try and make rowing my job, and I was young enough that I'd give it a go. So then got a job at Barn Elms as a full-time coach there, did that for 5 years, and then got the opportunity to start Fulham Reach and sort of bring all those strands together really. So. Focus on outreach in rowing and inclusion, which is really where my passion is in the sport. But also then take the stuff I learned from running a high performance centre at London and the world of business and try and put it all together to get a charitable project that has a proper plan behind it. And you know, it went all right. It was 10 years of fun, and we grew it to being, by the time I left, we had 25 people working there. It was turning over $1 million a year. Twice British Rowing Club of the Year, I think three times now. They might have won it again recently.
And there are a whole host of other awards that they've won as well.
Yeah, and they've just won the Sports and Recreation Alliance Community Club of the Year, which is huge, like more than 100,000 sports clubs in the UK, and they've just won that. So it's great fun. You know, I think we started to help move the dial on inclusion in rowing and started to change what the sport looks like a bit in this country. And then from there, it became time for me to sort of think of a new challenge, and that's why I ended up in the museum, and we're trying now to turn this beast around and make it profitable again.
Perfect. So sort of back onto sort of the Fulham Reach part a little bit. So what do you think it is that sort of turned that into success? Obviously, when you first started, it was very much, there was nothing there, and you sort of set it up. How did you manage to sort of attract those people into the club in the first place and then sort of retain them following that, and then sort of push some people onto sort of bigger, better things following that as well?
Well, there's a few different things that came together to make Fulham work. So first and foremost, there was a bit of luck and a bit of foresight by the people involved in British Rowing at the time, so the late Dias was leading it, whereby the developer was going to build these flats, and they were originally actually going to put in a junior high performance centre before Caversham was built. And eventually, I think then when Caversham started coming online, it was a switch then over to let's make it a community centre, a community boat club. But what really helped us, it was well funded. So the developer had to put £3 million quid behind it initially. So that's a decent start in anyone's books. But we spent maybe, I think just over £1 million of that getting everything set up. So, you know, all of the kit you need to run a boat club, we spent $250,000 on boats alone. And then you've got to fund the operating loss until you get up to the point that you're starting to break even. So having that funding behind us was really key. And it's so important any startup to be, you know, have that runway in order to get your operation up running. And I think that we got the right people involved early on. So we had a really good chair who was who was motivated for the right reasons and had the right contacts to help drive it. And then I think what really helped was our intent was right. So we were genuinely motivated by opening the sport up, and it wasn't a proxy for trying to win the Wyfolds every year with, you know, with something. And so I think that really helped draw people in because they were there for the right reasons. And all of our comms were focused around opening the sport up and bringing people down, and that really resonated with us. Mm-hmm. When I started it, I thought what would happen is I would open this whizzy club with shiny boats, and all of my rowing mates would join, and that didn't happen at all. So what I learned from that is, I sort of knew it already, that rowers are quite tribal, but rowers are incredibly tribal, and people just don't switch clubs that easily. And so we had to pivot the business plan pretty quickly to then say, all right, well, we're not going to be a membership group that knows how to row with a few learn to rows. We're going to go completely for learn to row, and we're just going to teach novices. So by the time I left, I think about 90% of our adult members were homegrown. So we taught them all to row, and then we had a few people drop in that knew what they were doing. But I think that then also helped the club grow, because it really was that atmosphere of, it doesn't matter if you don't know what you're doing. You know, we genuinely, not only welcomed novices, but we proactively went out to find them. So it just creates that atmosphere of, you know, it's okay to not know what you're doing, it's okay to learn. And it just sort of snowballed from there.
And from that, there have been sort of various successes, and I was reading one story on the website about a young gentleman that managed to sort of get a scholarship into Eton sort of through Fulham Reach Boat Club. Could you sort of, are there any more stories?
Well, that boy was called Skyler. I say boy, he's a bloke now. He was our first bursary. So he, him and his dad walked in one day. He was 12 years old, I think, at that point. He was just about 6 foot tall. And his dad said, we think he should row, but we can't afford the fees. And we all said, yes, he should definitely row. And don't worry about the fees, we'll figure it out. So we got him down and got him going. And it was a really impressive story, because it also turns out that he's very gifted academically, but also homeschooled. And he'd hadn't found a mainstream school that worked for him. And his dad was saying that he'd struggled to find support within mainstream schools. And sort of whether you're academically gifted or not, as a 12-year-old, if you're homeschooled, that has a knock-on effect on your confidence and how you interact with people. And so he was so quiet when he joined us. And then all of a sudden, he was surrounded by a bunch of people saying, you're amazing, look how talented you are, you're going to go really far in this sport. And you just see him sort of blossom. And then he got back into a mainstream school with West London Free School, who helped him out, and were really supportive of him and what he was trying to do. And then his dad was telling their friends that he was rowing, it was going well. And someone said, have you thought about scholarships? I think Eton row, why not try them? So he did the first round of testing for Eton and got in after the first round of testing, which is fairly unheard of in the scholarship process. And so, got a full scholarship to Eton, full scholarship on the academics, I should add, not for sport. But then got into their first eight. I think he reached the semi-finals before getting knocked out to Radley in his first go. I can't remember happened the second year. But then got on a full scholarship for Stanford Uni. And so he's gone up to there. And then, you know, as well as sort of those real headlines like Skyler, we've got tons of kids that have come through who, you know, maybe won't go off to Stanford or get an Eton first aid, but they were scared of water and now love rowing, or they were being really difficult at school and now have learned to control themselves and actually set goals and push on. So there's tons of those stories around the place that they probably don't make the papers, but really have the impact ongoing.
Of course. And rowing, I've sort of found myself as well, is a sport that initially seems to have like quite a closed door, but on the back end of that, it does open up so many opportunities. And for sort of young guys or young girls and girls at school, like, it can get you into sort of new positions and sort of looking at university, and then even going forwards on a CV, having done rowing, that's a thing that a lot of employers do look forward to and do think, like, appreciate. And I think that's something that rowing as a sport particularly is quite well at sort of promoting, and that sort of network as well. What do you think it is about rowing that sort of helps promote that idea?
I think people that know of rowing understand that it's really hard. Like, and I think it sets itself apart from sports in that respect, because it's, as we know, it's strength endurance. It's a training-led sport, so, you know, it's not football where you play a match every weekend and that's part of your training. You know, we race half a dozen times a year, maybe. So it's a volume-based training-led sport that's really hard physically. It's difficult technically, and we do it through the winter, which still blows my mind. So when it's July and August, we tend to wind down. And so, you know, employers aren't dumb, like, they know that. And so if you find someone on a CV that's got rowing experience and you know, has rowed at a decent level, mm-hmm. you know there's certain things they've gone through to get there, over and above other sports, and I say that confidently, and I'll challenge most of the sports that want to have a pop at that. But yeah, I think if you can show you've rowed to a decent level, it demonstrates a level of dedication, a level of being able to push on. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it, you know, throughout my career, all the, you know, people that don't do sport, even let alone rowing, mm-hmm. you know, they sweat the small stuff and, you know, and find it difficult to really push. And I think that's what rowers are good at. I think we're good at seeing the bigger picture. I think we're good at pushing ourselves. Yeah. And I think that makes a really, really good employee.
And with that in mind, rowing as well is a sport that helps develop people into that mindset as well. So not everyone that will initially look at rowing will be this character. What do you think it is that helps develop people into that? So, like, for example, when into Fulham Reach, I'm sure there'll be people that coming in that have never participated in sport outside of what they might just sort of do in the playground or whatever. What do you think it is that helps rowers sort of develop themselves outside of a sporting perspective?
Well, I think the interesting thing with rowing is you get to see progress really quickly. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons people get hooked on rowing.
Yeah.
Because it's almost a straight line between the number of sessions you do and how good you get mm-hmm. initially. And then that line starts to flatten out as you get a bit more experience. I think that's a really addictive thing. I think there's a lot of sports where people are naturally just really good. So mm-hmm. like I've got kids in primary school and you can already see who the footballers are, who the runners are, and there's not the PE teachers training them, that's just their DNA. You know, everybody that starts in rowing is terrible. Like no one's any good at rowing when they first sit in a boat and grab an oar. Progress makes people get addicted and then they do all that hard stuff. Mm-hmm. You quite often see with novice rowing or people that are trying to bring people into the sport, they think, well, let's sit them on the erg mm-hmm. and we'll teach them on the erg and then they'll fall in love with the sport.
Yeah.
And I am yet to see anybody sit on a rowing machine and get inspired to go rowing.
Yeah.
I think you get inspired by going on the water, mm-hmm. seeing that progress, and then sitting on the erg is a necessary evil to get quicker on the water. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just always progress is the reason people keep coming back.
And I think, so I spent a little bit of time coaching down on the ISIS in Oxford, and I think that's such a great platform for hundreds and hundreds of people to get exposed to rowing, and it's quite a big thing obviously in Oxford with the boat race, and a lot of people are inspired by that. What do you think we can do to sort of draw people in outside where they might not have those opportunities? So the college setup is set up so that anyone in the college can come down, jump in a boat and basically go for a session if they fancy it. I think to get into other clubs, there's a financial barrier of sort of signing up, and then there's also a few other barriers in terms of what if I don't like it, I don't want to sign up. How do you think we could break down those barriers to get more people involved in the sport?
Well, I think you've got to recognise that most clubs are run by volunteers. Yeah. So you could, ideally you'd have a volunteer that's just happy to take people out. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, a lot of clubs are lucky enough to have that, and that's part of the reason I got involved is because, mm-hmm. you know, someone's parent is happy to take us out. One of the things we ran at Fulham which worked really well was running one-to-one sessions.
Yeah.
So we were set up in a way that anybody could walk in off the street, book a one-to-one with the coach, mm-hmm. didn't have to be a member, and just try it and see what they think. So that worked for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, it got us new members because mm-hmm. we weren't saying commit to a learn to row course, just come and have a go. And then we put them out in, you know, like a glide one single with floats, so like you basically can't flip it.
Yeah.
And stick them on a rope and then eventually get them off the rope. And, you know, people felt like they had a really good session. Mm-hmm. They weren't worrying about capsizing, so they enjoyed it. But the other thing we found that worked really well with that one-to-one was it was a massive revenue generator for us. Mm-hmm. We were doing about 80 grand turnover a year on mm-hmm. one-to-ones.
Okay.
So it's like a significant part of the business. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to employ someone just to think about one-to-ones.
Yeah.
Not even coached them, like just booked them. So, you know, it was a really good way to get people to join and mm-hmm. to get them to taste the sport and the club and see if they want to come in. But it helped generate cash as well. So I think if clubs could find a way to book one-to-ones and, you know, get a coach to do it, mm-hmm. if they're really brave, they could commit and pay a coach. And then, you know, I'm sure it would be there because we found that demand was never a problem. Like we were having to stop people trying to sign up because it was that busy.
And what was the sort of marketing approach to that? Like, how did you get people sort of invested and interested in signing up in the first place?
Well, we did a lot on digital. So I come from a background in digital marketing, so we did a lot on the social platforms. We did paid advertising on the platforms. And then we just tried actually just to push the message as much as we could on the bigger stage. And I think that's one of the things that worked for Fulham is that everyone knew about us and we were quite gobby. but it was things like taking those opportunities to come. So the new boat race director came along and said, you know, there's a community club on the course, we should work together. That was Michelle Dye, who now runs Wimbledon, or she's an ops director at Wimbledon.
Okay.
So we worked together and we started the first bit of junior rowing as part of the boat race, and now they've got a junior boat race which goes off a couple of days before the main event. What else did we do? We, you know, we got in the FT, the Times, the Guardian, like we pushed pretty hard. But I guess also we had our niche of this you know, traditional sport, now had a club that was forward-looking, open to all, and that made for a good story, and so we were able to promote quite widely. But we put marketing pretty pretty centrally to all of our activity down there.
Yeah, of course. And then, I guess, if you don't mind, just sort of talking more about the River and Row Museum, because that sort of ties into that a little bit there. What you're trying to do now is sort of take a project that's not really done quite as well as people might have hoped in the past, and sort of hopefully uplift that and bring that more into the sort of public spotlight. What sort of approaches are you taking there?
Well, you're right, so it's 25 years old.
Yeah.
It had a really good start. So the year after it opened, it won Museum of the Year. 2013, it existed in the top 50 museums in the world for the Times, and then it's gradually been on the wane since then. And then COVID hit, and then a closure. So COVID was obviously bad for all business, well, nearly all businesses, but for visitor attractions and museums, like, it just, it blew the doors off. It was awful, and we were one of the last things to be able to open back up. But then following that, the trustees realised that there just hadn't been that period of investment in the building and in the business to keep the museum buoyant, to keep it relevant and modern and able to grow. So they closed for 9 months and spent about best part of £4 million sorting the place out. So converting the building we're in now into office space, putting a new roof on the main body of the museum, new CCTV, new IT systems, hired a new director, you know, all this sort of stuff. In order now that we can turn the business around and move it from an operating loss to break even. And it's never actually reached break even. It's always had a benefactor in the background that's been able to write a check to keep it upright. And that's not happened for a while now, which I don't think people realise. We, as a board, have said, like, no more. Like, this now needs to stand on its own two feet properly. So I've been brought in to lead that turnaround. So we've got a three-year plan, which we're launching this month, to get us back into break even. It's all about tripling our income whilst holding costs where they are, which is a bit of a challenge. That's why they've employed a rower. And so far it's going well. Like, we just closed off the last financial year. We were about 15% ahead of budget, so that's good. So sort of we're still moving in the right direction. And now we start to really think about, as we did with Fulham, like, how do we really shout about the museum? How do we get it front and centre of people's minds? And I think our year one numbers, which we're in now, we'll be able to hit reasonably confidently. Year two, with a couple of wins, I think is pretty confident as well. And then year three, I'm not too sure about. That's quite a big step. But as we test and refine the plan over years one and two, we should find the actions we need to hit year three.
And something that you mentioned before was that as the River and Row Museum grows, there'll be sort of new opportunities for it. And there was sort of, you mentioned, obviously, it's a fantastic location, like on the Thames, in Henley. There are sort of opportunities to expand it outside of being just a museum and sort of opening that out to more people. What sort of things do you think, like, could be done in that respect?
Yeah, I think we've got to, as a museum, as you say, think beyond being a museum. So we've got to think of ourselves much more as a community centre, if you like. So we have to have an object and we have to have a story about the object, but then it's, what events do we spin off that object, and what education can we deliver, and what experiences can we deliver as well? And so we're keen that it is much more than just a museum. So I've always thought that we should be, you know, we talk about the river, we should be taking people out on the river.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's a partnership with someone like Hobbs, who are based in Henley and doing river tours,
mm-hmm.
or whether we break out our own boats and we start taking people out in rowing boats and mm-hmm. teaching them to row. Or I think, you know, we talk a lot about Henley Regatta, we should be mm-hmm. taking people down the course when it's up
yeah.
and putting out the markers and telling the stories of what's happened over the years. But also then I think the museum can start to play into that idea of inclusion like mm-hmm. we did at Fulham. We do a lot of work on the education front, so we see about 3,000 children a year
mm-hmm.
From mainstream education, but we're now going to work a lot more with SEND pupils and partner with the Rivertime Boat Trust so that we can take particularly wheelchair users out onto the Thames
mm-hmm.
and experience all that the river has to offer. So yeah, it's about much more than just objects and stories,
yeah.
although that's our bread and butter. It has to be about community, about the events. And one thing we're looking at also now is how we operate the museum after dark. So mm-hmm. we close to the public at 4 o'clock, but we have a late license till 1 a.m.
Yeah.
So what we're working on at the moment is what do we do from 4 in the afternoon till, you know, 12:59 a.m. the next
yeah.
morning. So that's, you know, going to be all sorts of live music and comedy and bits and pieces like that.
And when we were talking earlier, we mentioned how some of the exhibits were sort of a little bit scattered, and you were sort of hoping to make a bit more of a timeline and progression around that. And something you mentioned was sort of talking about the future of rowing, and that's something that I've talked about quite a lot on this podcast and talking with coaches and things like that about what we want to see in the future of rowing. What do you think that future looks like for you?
Blimey, that's interesting. Well, I think it's a good reason to come to a museum, because that's part of what we do, is make predictions based on
yeah.
what's happened in the past, because life is all about patterns, really. So where do I think it's going? I think it's in a real challenging spot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that broadly the sport is guided by what happens at international level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think reduction in racing length is, well, it's an interesting one, because although LA is going to be 1500,
yeah.
every international event up to LA is at 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully it's just a bit of an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that rowing is reasonably secure at the Olympics up to the 2030s, but beyond that, possibly not. And it might be the beach sprint takes over.
Yeah.
But I think if beach sprint takes over, actually, from my point of view, that makes the sport less accessible. Because if you have fewer people rowing on inland waterways, then you can only really go to the coast
mm-hmm.
to take part in the international events. That I think it's going to be harder to get more people down to do
mm-hmm.
that and take part. So I don't know. I think it's in a tricky spot. It's in a really tricky spot. And if I was world rowing, I'd be pushing pretty hard to keep the format as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But then equally, you've got to try and figure out the rowing lake is a hugely expensive part of
yeah.
the Olympic setup.
Mm-hmm.
And cities that are bidding for the Games have to work out how they're going to afford to build that. And then understand it probably won't be that well utilised afterwards. So maybe there's something in there about people like Fulham Reach or whoever it is demonstrating the onwards use of these places
mm-hmm.
as part of the legacy of the Games. I think it's a challenging time for the sport.
Yeah.
I think the other risk it's got also in this country is the weather.
Yeah.
Because we're just losing, well, we've lost a season of racing.
Mm. So flooding happens at most clubs around the world, and certainly in the UK. What do you think it is? Is there anything we can do as rowers to sort of help this impact on the environment? How can we sort of reduce that impact and then potentially, looking forwards, even sort of go carbon negative?
Yeah, I think, actually, to be fair, Adam Freeman-Pask, that's now running Fulham Reach, is doing a really good job there in terms of testing.
Yeah.
So it was at Fulham Reach where they did all that testing before the boat race
yeah.
that highlighted the E. coli levels.
Oh, yeah.
So I think rowers being able to do that, you know, we're on, as a body, we're on the water all the time, like
mm-hmm.
we should be able to test it and be able to report that testing. I think that's something we can do really well.
Yeah.
I think from the water company's point of view, they've, you know, it's difficult for them to be held to account
mm-hmm.
where no one has the data.
Yeah.
And so now we're now able to go and get that data
mm-hmm.
and there's a few different organisations that are trying to collate all of that data into one coherent, you know,
mm-hmm.
Piece of news. So I think if we as rowers can do that, that will have a big impact.
Yeah.
I think ultimately we have a Victorian sewer system across
yeah.
the country, that isn't designed to deal with the number of people we've got,
mm-hmm.
coupled with additional planning regulations that make it don't put flooding necessarily at the heart of those applications,
mm-hmm.
Coupled with, you know, intensive agriculture and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So I think the primary thing we have to do is invest in that sewage infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
sort out the storage tanks, stop this situation from happening that when we get heavy rainfall, everything backs up and it just flows out into the river.
Mm-hmm.
We have to create bigger storage capabilities to stop that from happening.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I think it's being able to get that data is mm-hmm. probably the big thing we can do.
And I guess from someone that's not involved in sort of sewerage, all we can really do is shout about it, I guess. And I guess that's something that you've done in your position at the River and Rome Museum. And I think if, as a river user myself as well, and any rowers, I think it's sort of a really good opportunity to be vocal. And I know at the boat race and sort of the post-race interviews, it was Lenny Jenkins that said, actually, we all had E. coli, and it's because people are putting poo in the water.
Yeah.
And I think things like that, if you're given sort of a platform to be vocal about it, I think it's really important that you are, because otherwise there's not going to be change.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think for the museum, what we want to do is try and host that debate moving mm-hmm. forward. So there's really good organisations that can lead the debate. So mm-hmm. whether that be River Action or the Rivers Trust or Henley Mermaids or Greener Henley. But what we can do here is bring everyone together.
Yeah.
I've got a great vision in my head of all those groups that are active in terms of Clean the Water
mm-hmm.
and Thames Water and Severn Trent, all sat around a table like this,
yeah.
actually trying to figure it out mm-hmm. and figure out what the solution is. So hopefully the museum can help make that happen.
Excellent. I think that more or less covers the topics that we mentioned previously. Is there anything else that you'd like to cover?
I think I'd just say to people to come down to the museum.
And
as a sport, we're really lucky that we have our own museum.
Mm-hmm.
Not many sports do. So I'd encourage people to come down and have a look. The Henley Gallery is going to get updated first.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going to move on to the River Gallery, and then it'll be the Rowing Gallery. So I'm always really keen to hear if rowers come down and see the gallery,
mm-hmm.
what they think should be in it and what we can update. So yeah, I just encourage everyone to come down and have a look.
Yeah, and you gave me a little bit of a tour a couple of weeks ago, and there is some really cool stuff there. There's sort of the letter sent for the original boat race. There's all the boats that have been used in previous Olympics and all sorts of great stuff. And there's someone that's interested in history and rowing. It was really cool thing to have a look at. So I definitely recommend going down to have a look.
Great.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and I look forward to sort of seeing where the museum goes in the future, and hopefully we can sort of get some more people down.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks very much.